It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin birth rates are a window into the state at a given moment in history. We look at where they stand and what they say about our region. First, students from more than half of the University of Wisconsin campuses have filed complaints of sexual harassment or misconduct from teachers that have resulted in formal investigations. The allegations go back as far as 2014 and include hundreds of cases. Karen Herzog is the higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she broke this story. Karen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Judith.
What first drew you to look into this issue?
Well, of course, national attention has been focused intensely in recent months on sexual harassment in the workplace. UW system has some 32,000 employees, and obviously it's an environment where there's a lot of supervisory relationships, and then, of course, there are students who interact with faculty and instructors. So I put in an open records request under the state's public records law to find out how many complaints had been filed that specifically involved teaching, supervisory, and advising staff. In other words, those who are in a position that they could use a power differential. And got those results back in a preliminary format because it takes a while to get the full details, the names, the specifics, because of the legal process. But I was able to get an overview to get a good sense for the breadth of the issue in the UW campus system.
And so how widespread would you say this is in the UW system?
Well, it's hard to say how widespread it is because it's underreported, and that specifically was noted by UW-Madison. If you're someone who wants to keep your name out of it, if you're, say, a graduate student working with a professor and you don't want to identify yourself as complaining about your professor, you might want to remain anonymous. And in order for a formal investigation to be launched, you cannot be anonymous. There has to be due process. Mm-hmm. So it's more common than one would notice from the records that were produced. However, Madison also commented in their response that there was a survey in 2015 that was a real wake-up call for them because about half of the students who responded to the survey said they had been sexually harassed, and 22% of female graduate students identified a faculty member as the person who harassed them.
Karen, can you give us an example or two of specific situations that were reported and then investigated?
They vary widely. A lot of them are cases where there were inappropriate comments made, and perhaps there was a text message that was exchanged or something on Facebook. There were four cases specifically at UW Oshkosh where a faculty member or academic staff supervisor was actually involved in a relationship with a student. In one case, it was an athlete, and the individual as a faculty member actually resigned voluntarily after the relationship ended, and the student alleged that this faculty member sexually harassed them as they were trying to break up with this person. There were also a couple of cases involving athletics. There was one allegation at UW-Green Bay that an instructor had forced students to wear two-piece swimsuits. Now, that allegation was found that there wasn't substantiated evidence that this was a requirement and there was no action taken. But there's quite a variety of different complaints. In some cases, it's an employee who's not a student, but about half of the cases were students alleging that something had happened with someone in an instructional capacity, either a faculty member, a TA, an adjunct instructor.
We're talking with Karen Herzog. She's the higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She broke the story of widespread accusations and investigations of sexual harassment and sexual assault throughout the UW system. Karen, which campuses had percentage-wise the highest number of these complaints?
Well, UW-Milwaukee had the most formal investigations from 2014 through 2017. They had 34. UW Oshkosh had 19, which is also a relatively high number for comparing them to, say, like a UW-Madison, which had 7. And UW-Madison was very careful to point out that there are many different channels in which students could report something. They could go to the department head. They could go to college. Only those that are reported to their Title IX officer, to the person who actually does formal investigations, were included in this number. So as I said, it's underreported, and many cases are handled informally. Several other campuses just had, I shouldn't say just, but had a couple of them. UW-River Falls and Eau Claridge had two. Parkside and Superior and Extension each had one. Stevens Point, Platteville, Stout, three complaints. Green Bay, four. So it varies across the board, and again, it depends on whether students were willing to come forward and give their names.
And that was one thing I was going to say, Karen, that a higher number of complaints doesn't necessarily, I'm guessing, mean that there's a higher number of incidents. It may actually mean that the message has gotten out that if this happens to you, we want to know about it.
Exactly. And that's an important part of the message, that the UW system and campuses specifically have really worked to get the message out there that if you have something happen to you, we want to know about it, we want to deal with it. The UW system has a website for explaining, you know, how to go through this process of a formal complaint. That message is definitely out there that if something happens, we want to know about it, and we want to support you and fully investigate it. You can do it informally without your name being used, but then the person involved cannot be disciplined because of the whole due process requirement, but it could be handled informally in a different way.
Well, and speaking of punishment, what's the range of how these investigations have turned out? If, let's say, it is found that the complaint is valid and that the faculty member or academic staff has committed sexual harassment and sexual assault, what has the range of responses by administrations been?
Well, at least half of the formal investigations found that the claims were substantiated. And many times an employee was warned or referred for sexual harassment awareness training. In the case of 10 individuals, there's one that's not real clear, four resigned voluntarily, one including that faculty member who was involved in the relationship with the student at UW Oshkosh and allegedly harassed the student when she tried to break up with him. And then there were six cases where either the employment was discontinued, which I guess that would imply they were fired, or in a couple of cases, they just were not offered another contract. And in these cases, we're talking about instructional staff that would either be an adjunct or a teaching assistant, and they would just not be offered a contract for the next semester.
The University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh, as you said, has had a number of sexual harassment complaints, and there was reporting on settlements that happened. What do we know about those settlements?
Well, we know that there were two settlements at Oshkosh. We don't know many of the details, because, again, those details will come at a later time once the process is followed for obtaining employee records. That takes a little while. But the overview that I was given just mentioned that there were no policy violations that occurred in either of these two cases where there was a financial settlement. Both accused a faculty member of sexually harassing an employee. It didn't specify that it was a student. It said that the employee complained to a supervisor. The supervisor fired the employee, and allegedly that was in retaliation for reporting it. But it was unclear whether the complaints involved the same faculty member and employee or what the circumstances were. But again, they did not conclude there were policy violations, but they did agree to a financial settlement whose terms I have not been made privy to at this point.
Karen, earlier you mentioned the campus climate survey a few years ago that was really a wake-up call that showed that feelings of having been sexually harassed were much more common than I think administration realized. Do we know what kind of changes were implemented following that survey, and do we have any idea of the efficacy?
Well, across the UW system, one of the changes that occurred, President Ray Cross, UW system president, in 2014 created a task force, and that task force had representatives from all campuses. One of the things that came out of that was mandatory training for sexual harassment awareness on all campuses. UW-Madison specifically is working on creating a centralized system to track all the cases that would come from maybe colleges or departments, and also clarifying who's a mandatory reporter. If somebody comes to a professor, are they required under Title IX, which is the federal law that protects it's a gender protection so that you avoid a hostile environment, whether they are required to report this. So increasing the numbers of cases that are actually reported and tracked. But there's a whole move afoot to make it to encourage freer flow of information about this type of behavior.
And as we wrap up, Karen, what response have you been seeing to your reporting to this information being brought together in one place from people like System President Ray Cross?
So System President Ray Cross was very adamant that this is something that the UW system will not tolerate, that the campus community should be safe and welcoming places, that there's no room for compromise on that commitment. There's a lot of talk about changing campus cultures, and that's both harassment, sexual harassment, and also sexual assault involving students. This is a topic that wasn't a big topic even 10 years ago, and the awareness is just vastly improved, and I think a lot of people would agree that's a very good thing.
Well, Karen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Karen Herzog is the higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us today to talk about sexual harassment cases involving students and teachers at more than half of UW campuses. Right now, numbers can tell a story. Take birth rates, for example. As Americans, we put a lot of cultural weight on when we were born. We divide ourselves into generations and assign traits to those groupings. Our next guest says the number of babies born each year affects everything about how they grow up, from the job market to crowded classrooms. Malia Jones is an assistant scientist and a social epidemiologist at UW-Madison's Applied Population Laboratory. In a piece for WisConText, she writes that Wisconsin birth rates over time tell a story of demographic trends in the state, and you can find that by going to wiscontext.org. Malia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
I just love that we get to keep going into this data about who is here and how our lives are shaped over the decades. And, you know, before we kind of dig into the data itself, why choose to look at birth rates?
Well, new data come out about birth rates every year, and demographers follow these trends really closely because it does affect so many different social processes. And when the most recent year's data came out in 2015, we thought we would take a look at the whole history of this trend.
And let's take it by generation. What kinds of birth rate trends were we seeing in Wisconsin, for instance, during the baby boom?
Well, during the baby boom, of course, most people know we saw a tremendous spike in birth rates. And so during the Depression era of the 1930s and then the World War II era birth rates, the total fertility rate was hovering around 2.5 or so, which is can be interpreted as the one-year average number of children that a woman will have. Just after World War II, during the baby boom, those rates spiked tremendously starting in about 1945. And in Wisconsin, they continued to go way up all the way until 1960. Hmm. In 1960 was the peak here in Wisconsin, and the total fertility rate was over 4. So that is quite high.
And that was about on an average with national, or were we above?
It was
or below?
A little bit higher than the national average. Yeah, Wisconsin's peak total fertility rate during the baby boom was a little bit higher than the national.
And so, Malia, you said that we hit that high in about 1960, but then there was a steady drop. Why was that?
Well, one reason was that in 1960, the FDA approved birth control pills. And so that made it a little bit easier for women to control their reproduction. At the same time, of course, the 1960s saw these tremendous social changes. And there were increasing opportunities for women to go into higher education and complete college, which is, in general, more education means less children for women. And also then, of course, enter the workforce. And that raises the opportunity cost of having babies. So those factors kind of all come together in the 1960s to produce that big drop.
And how long did that decrease continue? Was there a point where it leveled out, or...?
It sort of leveled out in something like the early 70s. There's a little bit of a what's sometimes called the echo boom in there, which is when the earliest of the baby boomers were having babies themselves. And so because of the large number of people having babies, we had a large cohort of babies in the 1970s. And it's been fairly level since then. at something like 2.1 children per mother.
And you write that this post-boom era continues, and then between 1987 and 2007, you say that Wisconsin's birth rate started to split with the national rate. What was going on the national level, first of all?
Yeah, so it's an interesting process because it really has nothing to do with the birth rates of the people who are in Wisconsin. Wisconsin's birth rate remains on this sort of slow decline that it's been on, this trajectory that it's been on since the 1970s. But in other parts of the country, they've received a lot more immigrants from other places that have generally higher birth rates, especially in the first generation. Hmm. And so those higher birth rates among people who are foreign born produce higher total fertility rates in receiving states. Like, for example, California and Texas have considerably higher total fertility rates than Wisconsin. And that's because of the higher fertility rate of those foreign born people who are coming in. And I would just add also that the birth rates in Wisconsin have dropped considerably below replacement level at this point. And as we approach the years when a lot of those baby boomers are retiring, it's really concerning. It would be good to have a higher total fertility rate in terms of economic growth and social reasons. So
we're talking with Malia Jones. She's an assistant scientist and social epidemiologist at UW-Madison's Applied Population Laboratory, and we're looking at historical data on Wisconsin's birth rates. And Malia, you just mentioned that states with higher immigration levels tend to have higher birth rates. That made me think, how much do you and other data people look at the differences, for instance, between maybe U.S.-born people, but from different ethnic and cultural backgrounds? How much difference is there there?
We do see differences in the total fertility rate, certainly between people who are native-born and people who are foreign-born, and that's based on their country, that's related to country of origin, mm-hmm. generally. I don't know those numbers off the top of my head, but our largest immigrant streams at this time come from Mexico, which does have a higher total fertility rate than the United States in general.
So there's a noticeable difference between foreign-born and U.S.-born. Are there differences between U.S.-born racial groups?
I believe that there are, and it's age specific. So I don't have those numbers off the top of my head either. But yeah, you would see higher fertility rates among based on age. So one of the things that we see that's really striking mm-hmm. when we look at fertility rate by age and by race is that whites in particular have later age at first birth, which produces fewer children overall. And so when you compare the total fertility rates of different ethnic groups, you would see part of that pattern being driven by the age that people have their first child. And some of that, as I said before, is related to educational attainment. So the longer people are in school, the later they tend to have their first child.
So what are we seeing now or with the most recent data of Wisconsin birth rates?
So right now, in the last, say, 20 years, we did see a little bit of a bump up in the total fertility rate. It was hovering at around 2 children per woman for a number of years between 2003 and about 2009. But since the Great Recession, we have seen that drop back down to about 1.8. That's true here in Wisconsin. It's also dropped since the Great Recession nationally, and it has not bounced back again. So there seems to be this really sort of long-term effect of the Great Recession depressing the fertility rate.
So you were saying that you look at foreign-born versus U.S.-born, also the age at which women start having children, and that can affect it. Are you able to look at the data and see differences in, for instance, urban versus rural?
I suppose you could. So one of the challenges that we face as demographers is the amount of detail we get in the data is not always what we would want. And these data that we use are at the state level. If we had access to data at, say, the county or even better, sub-county level, we could really compare the total fertility rates between urban and suburban and rural places. And we are able to do that for lots of things. I don't think we can do it at the census tract level for fertility rate.
Well, and we've actually spoken with you before about definitions of what is rural,
right,
and what is urban, and those
I was
are,
thinking that too.
Those are very
the question.
Yeah. That seems to be up for debate,
right,
depending on who you're talking to. So, Malia, you mentioned, as we are all very aware, because it's in the news a lot, that baby boomers are, you know, retiring and going on things like Medicare at, you know, thousands a day, and here we are with either flat or declining birth rates. That seems like kind of a recipe for disaster as we're trying to keep certain, you know, social programs and tax base and things like that strong.
Yeah. So those high rates of those high birth rates during the baby boom era have always produced challenges in terms of the number of people in that cohort. And so I think baby boomers will probably recall having overcrowded kindergarten classrooms. And when they entered the job market post-college, there was a real scarcity of jobs because there were so many of them competing for the same jobs. And now we have reached the point when they are preparing to retire and entering the years when they will be the highest burden on our healthcare systems. And that's going to present a real challenge because as they retire, their forces will not be replaced in the workforce with people who are native born. Mm-hmm. We're going to be increasingly dependent on immigrant labor to replace those jobs and grow our economy.
Well, Malia, thanks so much for joining us and explaining the numbers.
Thank you.
Malia Jones is an assistant scientist and social epidemiologist at UW-Madison's Applied Population Laboratory. She joined us to talk about the history of birth rates in Wisconsin, and you can read that article at wiscontext.org. First, perfectionism in college students is increasing. According to data that surveyed British, Canadian, and American students, perfectionism is up 33% since 1989. A big part of perfectionism is about putting pressure on ourselves to meet high standards. Lots of people can struggle with that. Here's a clip of writer David Foster Wallace in an interview with WNYC in 1996, talking about his own struggle with chasing perfection.
You know, the whole thing about perfectionism, the perfectionism is very dangerous because, of course, if your fidelity to perfectionism is too high, you never do anything. Because doing anything results, it's actually kind of tragic because it means you sacrifice how gorgeous and perfect it is in your head for what it really is.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple of years, I think, where I really struggled with that.
Jane Addams is a social psychologist, writer, and coach. She recently wrote a piece for the New York Times called More College Students Majoring in Perfectionism. Jane, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's nice to be here, Judith.
And how would you define perfectionism, Jane?
Well, it's an enduring personality trait, and it is a quality that makes people need to live up to a certain standard, whether it's theirs or someone else's, to be perfect in some specific, if not every way. Perfectionism isn't usually just about college performance. If you're a perfectionist as a student, you're probably a perfectionist in other areas of your life too.
It seems like everyone is different, and so I'm guessing everyone's idea of what is perfect is different too. How do we form those ideas and those images?
It's hard to know. It may, in fact, be constitutional and innate. It may be reinforced by your culture. In some cultures, being perfect in what you do is seen as very important. It may come from nurture as well as nature. That is, if you are brought up in a family that that celebrates achievements, particularly academic achievements. And some people, you know, it's a quality that some people have and other people, it never shows itself. If they do have it, it's not an enduring personality trait.
And you referenced this a little bit. So some of it's coming from ourselves and some of it's coming from others. is there also a sense of perfection or what is perfect that we get from the society as a whole?
Oh, sure. One of the interesting things about that study is that it looked at three different aspects of perfectionism. And the first, which is the one that speaks to most of us, is self-perfection. You know, we set our own standards and we set them high and we fall short if we don't live up to them. And if we have them, you know, to an overwhelming degree, we find a lot of behaviors like the one that David Foster Wallace talked about. You put things off and you procrastinate them. If you procrastinate if you're a perfectionist, because if it will never reach the image you have of it, whether it's a painting or a term paper or a novel, why would you start it?
So internally,
self-oriented perfection, it can in fact be paralyzing and very stressful. And I find in my practice, I'm a coach mostly for parents of grown kids or young adults. And I found in my practice and in the practice of other colleagues that parents were coming to us in January disturbed by signs of stress that they'd noticed in their kids when they were probably closer to them in physical proximity than they had been since September. And for many of it, they seemed to ascribe it to this need to live up either to their child's own standards or to the standards of others or the standards set by social media.
Yeah, let's look at that, Jane. So social media in kind of the large sense is a very, very new phenomenon for young people. It's probably been around for most or all of their lives. But how is social media making perfectionism a different issue today than it was maybe 20, 30 years ago?
Well, 20, 30 years ago, the cultural models, whether it was slender, beautiful women, were everywhere. They were still in magazines, on TV, in movies, reinforced every way by the culture. Social media, of course, just intensified how quickly, how often we're subjected to the cultural surround. And young people are big users of social media. And, you know, you've heard of the fear of missing out, which is another social media affliction, that looking at the wonderful life that others seem to be living, whether it's an Instagram photo of, you know, a beautifully made up young woman or a Facebook post of a bunch of people you might know having a great time without you, you know, it's a different kind of pressure. And it's why the social media increase, the social oriented perfectionism has risen most sharply in the last 10 years.
Well, and I think it's interesting because certainly all those things were going on back, for instance, when I was in college. People were having great times. People were, you know, doing all the things that people today are, but we didn't see it. We didn't see it nonstop.
It was not in our face, and
exactly.
Certainly not in our Facebooks. And that's what's made it different, and that's why social media imposes its own kind of perfectionism, if you allow it to. And it's different, very different from self-oriented perfectionism, or even from what's broadly called socially oriented perfectionism, which is being oriented toward the standards of somebody outside yourself, your parents, your high school teachers, your professors, your admissions directors, somebody whose standards you need to meet in order to be part of that.
You know, I think back a couple decades and kind of the worst that we got faced with that was, I mean, you said TV and things like that, but it was those holiday family letters where when you would read them, it was like every child was, you know, on the verge of being a Nobel laureate and, you know. But it was once a year.
It was once a year, along with the Norman Rockwell Happy Family.
We're talking with Jane Addams. She's a social psychologist, writer, and coach. She recently wrote a piece for the New York Times called More College Students Majoring in Perfectionism. And Jane, you talked about working with parents a lot in your coaching practice. Can you give us some ideas of specific things that parents are noticing or what's kind of setting off alarms for them?
Well, the alarms are the either depression or procrastination or just plain short-temperedness, because you're cranky when you're procrastinating something you should be doing. But it was more the procrastination and the depression and the anxiety, you know, oh, I'll never get this done, or it's so difficult. It's not going to be, you know, nearly as good as it has to be, those kinds of messages. And you know, what parents can best do is to hear their kids, to listen to them, and to give them some worthwhile advice, which is do the best you can in the time you have. And then, you know, send them back to school and listen to them when they complain and keep reminding them that, you know, things they thought weren't good enough before were plenty good enough. Remember the SAT scores you sure you were bombing on? They got you into college.
And so
is
one of the things that we should maybe be focusing more on with young people, instead of praising them for things that they, when they do, you know, get the top score or really rise above the crowd, is part of it praising them for, you know, maybe being a well-rounded person or for being a good friend or a good member of the family, like some of those more intrinsic values, instead of everything being, you know, set with a kind of a scale of how you're doing compared to others.
Well, that's true. The other thing you can do when they say, hey, guess what? I got an A. You can say, that's terrific, honey. How do you feel about it? Because maybe she's, or I got a B. And you say, that's terrific. How do you feel about it? And if she says, I should have gotten an A, you remind her that, you know, she did the best she, if she did the best she could in the time that she had, she did a good enough job. And then send her a care package, you know. We need to understand, but unless the depression really gets almost clinically bad, that you can't function at all or get out of bed, or he, it's not anything we have to, I think, really worry about. It's a matter of understanding their perspective and easing their anxiety is the best way that we can. But I think the best response is always, that's terrific, honey. How do you feel about it? Because, or how did that make you feel, you know?
Because maybe that B was actually way better than she was expecting she was going to get, and it's a real accomplishment.
She might have said, really surprised because I didn't study for it that much. I mean, you know, that's an open-ended question.
We're talking with Jane Addams, a social psychologist, writer, and coach. Her latest piece for the New York Times is More College Students Majoring in Perfectionism. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Are you a college student struggling with this issue? Do you work in a college setting and see this or something similar? Or maybe you're a parent and you're worried about your child. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're continuing the conversation about an increase in perfectionism among college students. We're talking with Jane Addams. She's a social psychologist, writer, and coach. And we'd like to hear from you. Call us at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you need to get things perfect? Are you a parent who sees it in your child? Do you think pressures to be perfect have changed in the last decade or so? And how has social media contributed to it? Share your thoughts. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or give us a call at 800-642-1234. And Jane, you talk about a scale for perfectionism that you can take a brief quiz to find out where you stand. What kind of things indicate a tendency towards perfectionism?
There are 44 items on that particular scale. ranging from I never do as well as my friends do, to other people do better than I do, to I only have to live up to my ideas. You know, they're those kinds of questions that will elicit feelings enough to be scored, feelings of perfectionism. And some will hardly register. Some will just, you know, not have enough, will have negligible amount of perfectionism in them because people are different. But for people who are perfectionists, it's a good guide on where your perfectionism is oriented toward yourself, in which case, you know, there are a number of cognitive behavioral ways to modify that so that it doesn't cause you anxiety. But generally, a certain amount of self-oriented perfectionism is what gets most students where they probably are right now. And, you know, it's generally associated with success and conscientiousness. So perfectionism to that degree is a positive thing. It's negative when it interferes with the rest of your life and fully functioning in those other areas of your life and causes you unhappiness.
Let's go to
And it's fueled somewhat. This is a very competitive world that most college students live in, that we all live in. They had to struggle to get as far as they've gotten. They know they're going to have to struggle in a very competitive field to get a job when they get out. They've been struggling for a long time, and the competition is keeping them on their toes, if it's not, you know, knocking them off their feet. So it's not surprising that as society gets more competitive, that there's less room at the top or even on the way up, perfectionism would increase.
Let's take a call at 800-642-1234. And Kathy in Stevens Point is up first. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I was just listening to what the speaker was saying, and my daughter is going into pre-med. So she feels like she has to get a 4.0 to be competitive to get into med school. And I've seen also some of her friends who are trying to get into nursing. That's very competitive as well, trying for the same thing so that they can make it in the field they've chosen. So I think part of this is the competition, as you said.
And Kathy, what have you as a parent found to be helpful in trying to support your daughter?
Well, I do, you know, talk to her about not needing to get, I mean, not needing to get a 4.0 is not, I don't think it's mandatory, but she seems to believe it is with a four-year plan that she was given. So,
Thanks for that call, Kathy. And Jane, does that sound familiar to you?
It sounds very familiar. I have interviewed one man who's said to his son, you know, good, perfect is the enemy of good. And his son said, yeah, but good won't get me into medical school. Hmm. And he's right. But again, that's other oriented. It's oriented toward a set of standards that somebody else has set. And some people will get in and some people won't. Doesn't mean that you don't meet your own standards, but your own standards need to be reasonable. And, you know, in a very competitive world, it's just very difficult not to need to be perfect if good you are afraid is just not good enough.
It also seems like it's backing up in life as well, because now it seems like there are so many expectations of high school students to show that not only do they have the grades, but they're doing volunteering and they're well-rounded, they're doing sports and maybe theater. And it seems like it's getting younger and younger that that these expectations are being presented and then internalized by young people.
That's true. They internalize them. And what we as parents can do is to offer another perspective. And to suggest that they step back and take another perspective. Like, what will this matter in the long run? What will happen if my grades aren't good enough to get into college, the college I want? What will happen if I, you know, don't get into any college? You play out the what will happen if. What's the worst thing that could happen? And that helps to some extent. But I think reminding them that in all but a very few cases, perfect is in fact the enemy of good.
Let's go back to the phones, and Dan in Menominee is up. Hi, Dan.
Hey, so I'm a college student at UW-Stout. I just wanted to say that with so many kids today, and me, myself included, kind of striving toward, you know, doing things right and competing with one another, it seems like we're creating a group of people who would rather be in competition with one another than work with one another, and I just don't know that that's the most constructive thing for us as a society. I'll take my call off the air.
Great. Thanks so much for that call, Dan. And and Jane, that's a really interesting idea, that,
yes,
this perfectionism,
yes,
is fueling competition, too.
Yeah. You know, what are you going to do when there's no more top at the ladder? I think working for your own goals, particularly in education, learning for the sake of learning is as important, as more important than learning for the sake of grades.
Let's go back to the phones, and Gail in Fish Creek is up next. Hi, Gail.
Oh, hi. This is a really great topic. I've encountered so many people in my journey that have really struggled with this, and there's attention to detail, and then there's something else that just gets your persona stuck. And it reminds me of a few lines in a Leonard Cohen song, where it's, forget your perfect offering, ring the bells that still can ring. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
Wow.
And if we're perfect too early in our lives, we close off, we don't grow, we don't bring more light in our life. And I really think that we reach perfection in our last breath before we go.
Wow. Well, Gail, thank you so much for sharing those lyrics and those sentiments. And Jane, yeah, there's a lot there.
There certainly is. You know, competition for the sake of competition is not always the end all and be all. There are some people who need to win at all costs. But when the costs are self-flagellation and unhappiness and always falling short of somebody's expectations, either your own or someone else's, it's nice to put competition aside and focus on what you're doing for the intrinsic value it has to you.
I'm just thinking here, Jane, that, you know, if we are striving for perfection all the time in all different areas, you know, whether it's grades in things as different as math and art and music, you know, it's the rare person that is going to be even excellent, let alone perfect, in all these different areas. How much does that affect how we are able to like and love ourselves if we're always measuring ourselves against this unattainable goal?
Oh, I think you've really put your finger on something, Judith. What we lose in an overfocus on perfectionism is self-compassion. We lose compassion for ourselves and humility to a certain extent, to know that, you know, we are only human, therefore we are imperfect.
And are we harder on ourselves than we are on others around us generally?
Yes, I think so. I think we are.
And so maybe part of it is trying to have that compassion and that gentleness and that kindness that we might extend to a good friend, extending that to ourselves.
Exactly. We're usually the last person we think of when we think about being compassionate and caring for others. Part of caring for yourself is knowing what your limits are.
And Jane, thank you so much for being with us today. It was a great conversation.
Thank you.
That was Jane Addams. She's a psychologist, coach, and writer. She joined us to talk about her recent piece for the New York Times, More College Students Majoring in Perfectionism. A little after 4 this morning, really bright and beautiful moonlight woke me up. And it turns out, when I looked online, that that was kind of the opening act for a trifecta of lunar events happening in the early morning hours tomorrow. A super blue Blood Moon will be taking place, and that's a spectacle that hasn't been seen in the U.S. since 1866. So the three components are a blue moon, which is a second full moon in one calendar month. So we have two in January. February actually won't have a full moon at all. Then there's a super moon, which is when the moon appears larger and brighter because it's closer to the Earth than normal. And finally, a blood moon occurs when the moon passes through the Earth's shadow, and that causes a total lunar eclipse, and that gives the moon a reddish glow. Viewing will be best right before dawn, and NASA is actually going to be live streaming it. If you're up to see it, let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page and post a picture there if you're lucky enough to get one. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll talk about the spike in family farm bankruptcies in western Wisconsin and look at why the region leads the nation. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.